So hello everyone, I'm Janine Galleone, and it is a great pleasure to welcome you to the NEA BPD call-in series for the 2019 year. This year's series has a special focus on clinical practice and direct applications for therapists, and I'm excited to learn along with everyone else about treatments in a way that will be relatable for our broad audience. And I couldn't think of a better person to start off this series with than with tonight's speaker. We have Dr. Frank Yeomans. But before we start talking with Dr. Yeomans, I have a few brief announcements. First, Frank has prepared some handouts in case you want to follow along. If you haven't already, you can download the handout from NEA-BPD website, and that is www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. And there should be a. You can also email in to neabpd@aol.com. That's neabpd@aol.com, and we would be happy to send the slides along to you directly if you're having trouble accessing the slides. Also, while you're there at neabpd.com, it is a not-for-profit organization who supports itself only through donations, so please do support the continuation of such free programs such as this podcast and go to the donate page on the website, and we really appreciate and value anything that you can contribute. And lastly, please submit your questions and comments by email to that email address. It's neabpd@aol.com, and we will be sure to ask them to Frank by the end of the show. So that's all for the announcements. We'll get started. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Frank Yeomans. He is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Medical College of Cornell University and Director of Training at the Personality Disorders Institute, also at Cornell. He graduated from Harvard College and went on to obtain his MD from the Yale University School of Medicine and completed his training in psychiatry at the Payne Whitney Clinic at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He has participated in establishing training programs for psychodynamic therapy of personality disorders in numerous sites across the country, also it sounds like North America, Europe, and internationally. He's best known for his work on transference-focused therapy and has authored and co-authored countless articles and books on this pivotal treatment. So today, Frank will be talking about TSP as it relates to narcissistic personality disorder. And I am not going to hold things up any longer. I'm going to hand things off to you, Frank.
Thank you, Janine. Just want to make sure you can hear me now. Can you?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Yeah, okay, because it
perfectly.
Said the participants were muted. I was afraid I might be one of those. I just want to say to people who are here for this podcast that I'm very sorry to have to start this with a sad announcement. You may not know that our friend and colleague John Gunderson passed away 2 days ago. John valiantly fought cancer over a period of time, but finally he succumbed to it, as I said, 2 days ago. I'm sure all of you know his work, and many of you probably know him personally, so this is a very sad loss. John was a pioneer and a giant in the field of BPD. His contributions helped us understand the disorder as we know it today and helped us understand how to help those suffering from it. John was an extraordinary person. He never tired in his effort to carry our knowledge further. He never just rested on his laurels, but he always continued to push and expand what we know and what we do. John's personal warmth and generous spirit were instrumental in bringing others together and creating an atmosphere of collegiality and cooperation among all those who work in the area of personality, borderline personality. As Otto Kernberg said yesterday in commenting on John's passing, John combined his scientific openness and curiosity with an unusual respect and understanding of others' views and efforts to bring us all together in advancing our field. This is a painful loss. Barry and I felt it was important to communicate this sad news before tonight's podcast. And we also felt that John would want us to continue with our planned work in the spirit of helping others. So I'll just take a moment to let the news sink in before I begin with the program on narcissistic personality disorder. So the title for today's talk is Understanding Narcissistic Personality, A Brief Introduction. I say a brief introduction because it's a very broad topic. Now, if you move to slide number 2, the question there is, why have we been focusing on narcissistic personality disorder for the past years? When I say we, I mean those of us at Cornell, Weill Cornell's Personality Disorder Institute, headed by Otto Kernberg, and is a group who's worked together since the 1980s, trying to better understand personality disorders and how to treat them. In the context of our group, we realized about 10 years ago that more and more of the patients we were treating had narcissistic personality disorder. And we thought this is a challenge that is related to borderline personality disorder, but it has some differences. And we wanted to understand the similarities and the differences and to adjust our thinking and our treatment in some ways that could better address this population of narcissistic personality disorder. If you look at slides 3 and 4, they list some readings that might interest you. Slide 3 is 3 articles. I could send them to people if you're interested. And slide 4 is about a book that will be published later on this year where we're putting together what we've understood about narcissistic PD thus far and how to treat it. As we move to slide 5, I wanted to begin by talking about understanding narcissism in the context of personality in general. And when I say narcissism, I want to first mention that not all narcissism is bad. There is a healthy narcissism, which is a good thing to know. And a healthy narcissism is maintaining good self-esteem and an accurate and realistic appreciation of what one can do and accomplish and an acceptance of one's limitations. But let's think about personality in general before we get to the topic of personality disorders. Personality has to do with the enduring psychological patterns that underlie symptoms and complaints. So we're talking about a structure of personality, not just a treatment that tries to address symptoms that may be the manifestation of underlying issues. Personality has to do with the way we process, the way we take in, the way we understand reality around us. It's our characteristic patterns of thinking, of feeling, of being motivated, of experiencing self and others, of coping with situations in life, and of attaching to others and relating to others. Slide 6 elaborates a little bit on the issue of how we perceive self and others. We feel this is essential to understanding one's personality, how one perceives self and others, the sort of lens through which one perceives self and other, and we're talking both at one moment in time and across time. Personality, another way to look at it, is it has to do with how one assesses and adapts to the environment around oneself. Because one simple way to understand mental health is the successful ability to adapt to the circumstances that come our way in life. Now, if we turn to slide 7, I'm going to shift from talking about personality to personality disorders in general. When does the system of perceiving and reacting to the world around us become a problem? Well, it's when personality traits are rigid, are extreme, are maladaptive. It's sometimes involved in inhibition of normal behaviors, people who can't express, say, their anger or their sexuality, or sometimes it's an exaggeration of behaviors. Sometimes there's an excessive expression of anger or wild, kind of a chaotic sexuality. And in some people, there's an alternation between inhibition and exaggerated expression of what's within oneself. And the last point on this slide is that vicious circles develop in which abnormal behaviors elicit, provoke from the environment abnormal responses So what's in the patient's mind can get reproduced in the world around them. This is very important to appreciate because sometimes when somebody comes to us for help, it's not clear if the problem's outside of them or inside of them. We can talk more about that later. Let's move on to slide number 8, the key structural features of personality and personality pathology. What I mean by this is these are the variables, the concepts that we think about in terms of understanding one's personality. First and foremost is one's identity, the sense of self, which also includes, interestingly, the sense of others. The second important variable is the quality of one's defensive operations. Of course, that's a term from the psychodynamic literature. And defensive operations are one's customary ways of coping with external stress and also with internal conflict. By internal conflict, I mean, for example, conflict between an urge to do something and a prohibition against doing it. We also think in terms of an individual's quality of reality testing. How accurate is their perception and appreciation of the world around them? Or are there subtle or not so subtle distortions of the way they perceive what's around them? I'll talk more about that later. A fourth important area to consider in thinking about personality is the quality of object relations, which we might also think of as the quality of a person's interpersonal relationships, the degree to which they understand the nature of interpersonal relationships, the degree to which they can participate in mutual relationships versus relationships that tend to be one-sided. And a final but very important area of personality is moral functioning. Is the individual's ethical system coherent and realistic? Is it lacking or is it too rigid? So like most things in life, the moral system can err either to one extreme, too lacking, or to the other extreme, too rigid and harsh. Now, I'm moving on to slide 9, and I want to simplify for the sake of keeping this an introductory level talk. When we think about personality in our group, our focus is on identity. And this involves the sense of self. How do I think of myself? How do I experience myself? But also the way we experience others. So the question is our sense of self coherent and complex, or as it is in most personality disorders, is it fragmented, distorted, and superficial? Is it lacking in cohesiveness, in depth and complexity? Now, we find that in most personality disorders, there is that lack of a well-integrated, cohesive identity, and this leads to difficulty reading others, understanding others, getting others, but also difficulty reading and understanding the self. It leads to a lack of continuity in one's life experience, a very disturbing sense that one goes through life, but without life kind of building up as one would hope it to do. And a very important and distressing part of the picture of an uninterested is an internal sense of emptiness. And it seems from listening to a lot of the people I work with who have BPD that often the acting out is an attempt to escape from a horrible sense of internal emptiness. It's quite distressing. And we don't ever believe that somebody is truly empty. We believe that everyone has building blocks that can be put together, but there are obstacles that keep that from happening. Now, I'm actually going to skip the last point on this slide to keep moving on. What do we hope to achieve with treatment? We hope to help somebody gain a consolidated, cohesive, coherent, and deep sense of self. We try to help them develop more adaptive defenses, better ways of managing stress and internal conflict. Just to anticipate what I'll be talking about in a minute, we're going to try to help people get beyond splitting. Everybody who knows about BPD talks about splitting, seeing things as all good or all bad. And we all know that's not very adaptive. But the thing about splitting is it's not very adaptive, but it actually does provide some sense of stability in a very crazy world, so to speak. So when that's why splitting, although it's not so adaptive, is a defense mechanism. It's one way of dealing with anxiety, just not too successful in terms of personal and interpersonal growth. So beyond helping with the developing more adaptive defense mechanisms, along with this, there's an increased modulation of emotions. They become less intense, less extreme. And finally, there's better adaptation to the challenges of work and love, since we like to think everybody should have a fighting chance to get some satisfaction in those areas. Now, moving on to slide 11, I'm going to briefly review something called object relations theory. And I don't want to make that sound too intimidating. So what that means is a theory involving internal representations of self and others. Now, for various reasons, I won't go into. Others were referred to in the literature as the object of the drive, the object of the feeling, the person you love, the person you hated. So that's where the object comes in. But for practical purposes, the object is the other, but in an interesting way, other and self become almost interchangeable. So if we're going to talk about the structure of the mind, the way we see it, it is built up around what we call different object relations, dyads, a very specific experience of the self related by a strong emotion to a very specific experience of the other. In early development, these experiences tend to be all pleasurable when the caretaker is there and providing nurturing warmth and love, or all bad, all horrible, when the caretaker isn't there and the infant doesn't know that maybe it's just a matter of minutes, just a matter of time before the soothing will come. But in that moment, there's a sense of deprivation, pain, suffering, abandonment, and even sadism may enter into the feeling state. So in early development, before the mind begins to put experiences together, it's all or nothing, all heaven or all hell. So moving on to the next slide, which is 12, we think of these dyads, these internal images, which tend to be not fully conscious of self and other, as images that are internalized from experience, but they're modified by fantasies and defenses, by wishes, fears, desires, in an individual's mind. I'm saying this to point out that the internal images are often larger than life. So if you have somebody with a personality disorder in your life, or you have the problem itself, sometimes the images in your mind are larger than life, but of course they seem like they're what's there. And what we see is that these internal images are the lenses through which a person sees the world around them. So these dyads influence how the mind processes one's perception of self and one's perception of others. For example, in classic borderline personality, a very central dyad relationship paradigm is the abandoned self in connection with the abandoning other. Now, we're beginning to shift to some talk about narcissistic PD. In that particular disorder, the most central dyad is probably the superior self in relation to the inferior other, the grandiose self, the defective other. Although these dyads can shift around. And as we all know, somebody who's experiencing themselves as superior one moment might flip so that they're the inferior one at another point in time. Now, I'm going to get to the last comment on slide 12 in just a minute. The next slide, which is 13, introduces the concept of transference. For those of you who don't know it, it is simply the transfer of what is in an individual's mind to the outside world. This happens to everybody, not just patients, not just people with personality disorder. We all transfer what's in our mind to things on the outside. I meet a new person, they remind me of somebody I've known in the past. I transfer my thoughts about the person I knew in the past onto the new person. It might take time to see all the different ways the new person is different, but I already have certain expectations based on what comes from my mind onto them. The point is that if a personality disorder is present, there's more of this transfer of internal images onto other people, and there is less correcting of that transfer by the outside data. A person is less prone to take in data that would kind of modulate or attenuate the intensity of what they're putting from their internal world outside. Now, this transference is a universal phenomenon. We just find that it's very useful to think about it in the treatment setting, because that's our way of getting the most accurate window we think we can get into how a person's mind works. Now, if you look at slide 14, we have what we call the split mental organization, which is an early stage of psychological development, which unfortunately seems to persist in individuals with BPD, but also with NPD, narcissistic PD, but in a different way. I'll talk about that in a minute. So, as I said earlier, in early development, the mind has the perfectly heavenly self-other representations and the hellish ones. Now, if we turn to slide 15, in normal development, we realize, hey, things aren't that simple and straightforward. I've got my good side, I've got my bad side, so do all the people around me who I care about. And we accept complexity, and we kind of give up the idea of these extremes, which is actually a painful process sometimes, because we're giving up the idea that we or somebody we encounter could be perfect, which is something we often wish for. Now, the next two slides are going to begin to introduce the difference between borderline PD, as we see it, and narcissistic PD. In borderline personality disorder, the self-other dyads seem to be floating around, kind of ready to be activated by a trigger event. So, just for example, I'll be having a session with somebody, situation seems fine, everybody, the patient and I seem to be, you know, both in a kind of a positive way. The person notices me glancing at the clock. That's the trigger event. The person projects onto me the image of a rejecting other who can't stand being with them. So the person might say, oh, well, you know, if you don't want to be with me, just say so. You know, I don't have to darken your doorstep if it's that hard to be with me, which is, I would see as a projection. But the point here is that we went from a positive state to a negative state in a split second. And that's what happens, we find, with BPD. Now, if you turn to the next slide, it gets more complicated with narcissistic PD. Instead of having accessible this array of very different representations of self and other that are right there close to the surface in the borderline person, you have that chaos in the narcissistic person, but it's covered over by something we call the grandiose self. The grandiose self is a representation of the self, a sense of the self that just takes everything that's good and wonderful and smacks it onto the self representation, and it sort of discards and projects onto others everything that's bad and devalued and no good. So this is a more stable organization than the borderline organization. We say the patient kind of retreats into the grandiose self. It's an escape from the distress of the more disorganized borderline condition, and it's an escape into a narrative of the self which seems to have a coherence, except that it doesn't correspond that well to reality, as you'll see in some of my clinical examples. Now, the next slide, 18, talks about the grandiose self and the ego ideal. I think this is worth mentioning because Freud, who I still think has a lot to offer, talked about the ego ideal. That's something we hope we all have. It's a sense of what I would be if I were my perfect self. But in most of us, it's like the North Star to which you aim. You say, I want to be like that, but, you know, if I don't make it every day or if I never make it but keep trying, you know, at least I'm on the right track. And if I get close to it, some days it's fine. And if there's more of a gap some days, you know, I have to just keep doing my best. But for the narcissist, if you're not the ego ideal, if the reality of who you are does not correspond to that idea of your ideal, you're nothing. You're just garbage. So this can result in harshness and punitiveness, because our narcissistic patients can be very hard on themselves, as they can be very hard on others. So that's something about the structure. I want just for a minute now to talk a little bit more about the description, because there's kind of a overlap, but also a gap between the official American psychiatric nomenclature for diagnoses and the more psychodynamic tradition, although the two are beginning to come closer together. So if you know the DSM-5 criteria for NPD, it's about grandiosity, fantasies of success and power, sense of specialness, needing admiration, a sense of entitlement, being exploitative perhaps, lacking empathy. We might get back to that, it's a little more complicated. Having envy of others and being arrogant and haughty. That describes your classic narcissist, but it doesn't tell you what goes on in the mind of the narcissist. So if you know the new DSM, there's section 3, which provides an alternate model for personality disorders. Our group finds that closer to what we find in the clinical reality. And in this alternative model, you have impairments in personality organized around self and other functioning. There's impairment in self functioning, problems in identity, which I've stressed already, problems in goal-directedness, self-direction, and there are problems in interpersonal functioning, problematic empathy, lack of intimacy. And along with those underlying difficulties relating to self and other, there are particular personality traits, antagonism, grandiosity, attention-seeking. This is an interesting way to look at things, but it's missing a few items, which is in the parenthesis at the bottom of the slide. It doesn't include a sense of the type of self-structure, which I've described to you already, that pathological grandiose self. It doesn't introduce a pathology and understanding of envy. It doesn't talk about antisocial features, but at least it goes beyond just external behavior. So let's look more at the psychological understanding we have of narcissistic personality disorder. The pathological grandiose self, I've already said, in contrast to BPD, the grandiose self provides a facsimile and a pyramid of integration. That distinguishes NPD from the other major personality disorders. However, here's the key to understanding it. Here's the key to treating it. You have to see that this grandiosity, this grandiose self, is a compensatory self-structure. It's not what's really there. It defends against deeper feelings of inferiority and emptiness, which are really awful. However, it provides some stability as the person goes through life, but at a terrible cost, because basically of closeness and authenticness. Moving on to slide 22, I would say a little more about the grandiose self. It's superficial and distorted. It's rigid and brittle. It doesn't quite correspond to reality. I'll give a couple of examples in the next slide. It also requires, depending on the severity, some people seem to maintain a grandiose self without a whole lot of external support from the environment, but a lot of people require constant external support to reassure themselves, and therefore they're vulnerable to abrupt discontinuity in response to environmental stressors. Something bad happens and your sense of self collapses, crashes like a crystal globe into a million pieces. However, because of the grandiose self, people with NPD can have a more stable sense of self and more stable functioning than other PDs at the same level of severity. So let's look at slide 23, the grandiose self, reality, and interpersonal functioning. You can tell where I'm going. The grandiose self causes a problematic relation to reality. The need to maintain the illusion that the self includes all that is ideal and contains no negative elements. This leads to a defensive withdrawal from genuine relationships and to varying degrees from reality. Here's why I want to give you a couple of clinical examples. A therapist was presenting her new case to our supervision group, and she says, 50-year-old woman works in a secretarial position, but her goal in life is to become an international opera star. The group stopped the therapist and said, excuse me, did we hear you right? She's 50 years old and wants to become an international opera star. The therapist said, yes. We said, well, how many people do you know who are not to the age of 50, haven't become an international opera star, and it's likely to do so, to become that? The therapist said, I know that's a crazy idea, but I didn't want to burst her bubble. It's actually a good metaphor. We can think of the grandiose self as the narcissistic bubble. It's easy to burst. And here's the first challenge treating people with this disorder. You can't burst the bubble prematurely. It's a disaster. The person just feels horrible. But if you go along with it forever, you're not helping them get beyond it. So you have to have a real fine line. Now, another example. I was asked by the father to see a young woman who was 26 years old, 4 years out of college, living in an apartment supported by him, not working, not having any meaningful relationships, and saying she was writing a screenplay but not really producing much. She didn't have any distress. She came in for the evaluation, was a little annoyed her father was insisting on it, and I was kind of impressed with the lack of substance in her life. And at one point I said, you know, most people at your stage of life think about sort of building a career, you know, developing something around which they're going to base their work life. And she looked at me like I was kind of stupid to even ask the question. And she said, well, of course I think about that. When I feel like it's time for me to work, I'm going to go to Hollywood and become the head of a major movie studio. Now, we know that doesn't just happen. But her belief, her narrative, that that's what was going to happen to her, kept her from feeling awful, kept her from this inner sense of emptiness and inferiority. But it also kept her from being close to people, because people would go out to have coffee with this lady, and when they got to that part of the conversation, they'd say, well, that's a little odd, or do you really think that's possible? And then she'd sort of react to them as she did to me, like I was kind of stupid, or they just decide she's a little off and, you know, you can't get to know her much better or don't want to. So the middle point in this slide, contact with the real world threatens the person's psychological equilibrium. Putting it very simply, for the narcissist, reality is an aggression. They're to varying degrees in their own world. And it's a real precarious situation because it's not just self-esteem or pride. It's the entire sense of self that's at stake. The alternative to the grandiose self is to feel like you're annihilated. So slide 24 resumes a little bit of what I've said. The grandiose self protects against anxieties, but there's a price to pay. There's the sacrifice of genuine connections with others and with the real world. Now, moving on to slide 25, because I want to finish up with these slides and get to some of your comments and questions. There are a lot of different ways to look at some of the complexities of narcissism, but for today's talk, let's just look at two subtypes, the grandiose thick-skinned and the vulnerable thin-skinned. The grandiose are those people who are like a bull in a china shop. They just feel confident in spite of all evidence to the contrary. In contrast to the thin-skinned, where they might think they're the smartest person in the world, but they go to a party, and if they're standing with a drink and nobody comes up to talk to them, they feel like they're invisible, can't stand it, run home for cover. So interestingly, they both may have the same internal psychological structure of a grandiose self, but in the first case, it's stronger and beefier, and in the second case, it's much more fragile. Let's get to some treatment considerations. Why are patients with NPD so difficult to treat? Now, first of all, they shun relationships, and therapy is about working in a relationship. In my view of therapy, core of the work is what happens between the patient and the therapist and feelings that emerge in that work. And patients with NPD tend to have what we call a dismissive attachment style. Patients with BPD tend to have a preoccupied attachment style. Both of those attachment styles fall under the rubric of what we call insecure attachment, not feeling safe and confident in a relation with another. But the preoccupied, more typical of borderline patients, is ruminating. What does this person think of me? Did I offend them? You know, are they looking funny at me? You're always thinking about the other. The dismissive is, who cares about this person? You know, they're chopped liver. I don't need this person. So if you have a dismissive attachment style, you bring it into the therapy, and you're kind of aloof. Makes it harder for the therapist to connect with the patient. Second point, why it's difficult to treat patients with NPD, these patients have a tendency to provoke, to control, to devalue, and disengage the therapist. Although this may alternate with moments of idealization. But there's going to be a lot of devaluing. Like I said, my patient looked at me like I was kind of stupid. If you want to be a therapist treating these patients, you have to have a little bit of a thick skin. You have to be thin and thick at the same time. You have to let your emotions be activated. You let yourself feel what you feel. But you hold off. You don't activate it. So you just know in this treatment setting, you're going to get criticized, you're going to get devalued, you're going to get put down, and you have to absorb that. That's the only way to enter into the relationship. Anyway, another difficulty with treating patients with NPD is the patients often have a tendency to demand special treatment and privileges. But finally, if you're trying to understand the patients, how they tick in their mind, there's a resistance to that. Because there's an enormous fear of exposure related to the underlying fears of inadequacy, dependency, loss of status, and control. So we're moving to the last five slides. Working with the pathological grandiose self. Interestingly, in the first stages, this grandiose self obscures, it hides, it covers the more specific object relations dyads, those dyads that are full of chaos and distressing shifts from one mood state to another, from one affect state to another. That's all covered over by the grandiose self. So you have to first begin to dismantle or deconstruct the grandiose self to get at what's underneath. Now, the next comment, I won't spend a lot of time on, the absence of transference is the transference. That devaluing and dismissive attitude towards you is what you have to work with. The third point here is to expect a long phase of containing, that is you, the therapist, holding the warded off affect in the counter-transference. The way the counter-transference, of course, is how we, the therapists, are made to feel. And in a word, when I'm working with a patient with narcissistic PD, there can be moments when I feel like the most insignificant little pebble on the beach. Like, that is what we call projective identification. The patient is getting us to feel something that they feel but can't let themselves feel because it's too painful. So we have to, when you're made to feel this way, I put here, do not retaliate or dissociate, because often when you're made to feel that way, your gut reaction is kind of to defend yourself. Say, well, you know, my comments aren't all that bad. You know, I think you actually did learn from what I said last session. Don't defend yourself. You're just getting into a struggle. And don't dissociate. It's easy for therapists to sort of begin to sit back, and when what they're feeling gets too intense, say, oh, what am I going to have for supper tonight? Don't do that. Final point of this slide is early interpretations can be experienced as a criticism or an attack. You don't want to explain things before you're immersed in the feeling. I have to go on from that just for the sake of time. So we're getting to what happens as you get into the therapy. The therapist's neutral and accepting stance, that is, not reacting, accepting, containing, is in and of itself an implicit confrontation of the superior-inferior model of relating, which the patient assumes everybody is going to have in their mind. So the patient sort of begins to notice, hey, he's not reacting, he's not defending himself, he's just kind of letting this be. And it's an invitation to reflect on what's going on and to reflect on a relationship that might involve some mutuality. As these issues are addressed, it becomes possible to interpret at a deeper level the anxieties that have maintained the retreat into grandiosity. What is the patient really feeling inside that's so threatening they retreat into the grandiose self? Let's move on to slide 29. The evolution of the narcissistic structure as therapy advances. As the grandiose self is analyzed and dismantled, more specific self and object representations appear. You begin to matter more. Other people in the person's life begin to matter more. They begin to feel different states in themselves that they didn't feel before. So the patient presents as more related with clinging dependency, possibly longing for a loving relationship, guilt about the consequences of the aggression and grandiosity they had had before. And there can be depression that emerges, which may be a necessary way station to getting better and that we can work with. Now, let's move this just says, as we work on all this, we're beginning to promote normal identity integration. Moving on to the next to last slide, the latter phases of treatment or later. The dissolution of the grandiose self leads to distress and apparent chaos. And as I said, this can make the patient look worse before they get better. You can say that to the patient. You know, this may feel awful, but it's more real and it's something we can work with and move beyond. There's an alternation between the person's investing in an interpersonal relation outside of them, letting somebody else matter, and retreating back to the grandiose self. It's sort of a one step forward, half step back for a while, because this new experience of mutuality doesn't seem so solid. It's not so familiar to them. But in the course of the work, patients are faced with the consequences of the grandiose self, the inability to live in reality, loneliness, broken relationships, lack of consistent investment in work, and they begin to see what a price that is to pay for the way they've been defending against their anxiety. Now, depressive transferences emerge with the awareness of negative aspects of the self. I've talked a little bit about that, but let's skip that for now because I want to enter into the questions and discussion. Last slide and final comments from my end. As therapy progresses, the patient gradually experiences a conflict between their refuge into that grandiose self, that retreat from the real reality of the world. They begin to experience a conflict between that and some awareness they begin to develop about how seeking an ideal has eclipsed, has overshadowed the needs of the real self to be in real contact, of real relationships, real gratifications. Now, in the course of the therapy, the relationship with the therapist often becomes the representative of that latter element, the needs of the real self, the possible gratification of a real relationship, the anxieties that go with that, but the ability to work them out. So the relation with the therapist becomes a bridge to a real alternative to that exquisite isolation that the grandiose self provided. Now, in the course of this work, the therapist must address and be very aware of and very much in empathy with the pain and the sense of humiliation involved in this process as the patient goes through it. Now, I've gone through this very quickly. What have I left out? As I looked over the slides after I sent them out, I realized I haven't talked about the more serious, deepest levels of narcissism. I'm just going to earmark that perhaps for later discussion. There is a kind of narcissism. Otto Kernberg developed the term malignant narcissism. And in malignant narcissism, the envy of others is so intense that a destructiveness develops. You, even though you sort of project the superiority, you're eaten away by an envy. And even somebody who doesn't seem like they have superior achievements, the person with malignant narcissism kind of knows they're lacking just the basic stuff of being a contented, normal human being. And just seeing somebody who seems at peace with themselves can evoke an envy that can lead to real destructiveness and attacks on self and on relationships with others. Because if you envy, you might feel strong and sort of superior if you attack and triumph over somebody else. Okay, I'll end there, and we have what looks like about 13 minutes for questions. Not that I'm too obsessional, but... Okay, any comments or questions?
So thank you so much. That was fantastic, Frank. We do have some questions. If you don't mind, we'll start to work our way through them. And I also heard some points that you might want to elaborate on.
I lost you. Are you...
Yep, I'm here. So I'm actually curious. You spoke a little bit, you know, pointed to some of the pain that the therapists themselves have to absorb when you feel you're on the receiving end of being devalued and that feeling of being minuscule. I'm curious if you have any tips or advice for how to make that absorption more sustainable in the long run for treating this population to try to prevent burnout or, to not act on that countertransference.
Two very important tips. The first is to always remind yourself what the patient is saying is not really about me. It might be directed to me, but mostly it's what we call their transference object. They're talking about the image in their mind that they're sort of projecting onto us, kind of slapping onto us. So you have to say, okay, you know, they're talking to me, but they're not really talking about me. They're talking about what's in their mind that they're sort of pasting onto me. So just to remind yourself, what's being addressed by them is an element of their mind that you're kind of looped into. But the other, and perhaps the more important way to tolerate this, is to keep saying to yourself, this feels pretty terrible, but this is what they feel like underneath everything. This is helping me get in touch with their core feeling that is what they're defending against. So if I can tolerate this, if I can sit here and maintain calm and equilibrium and show that, you know, this can be contained, maybe we can think about it together. And you can sometimes get to know the bad parts of the patient's internal world by talking about them as they're described and experienced in you.
Do you ever give similar advice to family members? And do you ever pull family members into the treatment to help them deal with and work with the patient's narcissism?
Well, in general, if we have somebody with BPD or NPD, as part of our initial phase of treatment, we have a meeting with the patient and the family, whether it's parents or partner, spouse, because we think it's very important for people to be on the same page about how to understand the condition. First and foremost, because often people with narcissistic personality disorder have been treated for years as treatment-resistant depression. They're depressed because they're not living up to their ego ideal. They're not living up to their grandiose expectations. So they get depressed for psychological reasons more than biological reasons. And I've had patients who have been treated literally for 10 years, sometimes not only with medication, but with ECT. And the parents are spending part of their savings for retirement on all these treatments. And when you sort of offer this new perspective, it can be a relief for everybody involved, although it's a new challenge. But then you do explain a little bit of what I've been talking about in terms of the dynamics, and that can help people in the home navigate a little bit better what might have been hard to understand up until then.
Yeah, absolutely. That seems like it's an important part of the treatment and being able to maintain the relationships for the patients that they might be struggling with.
I was going to say to maintain it through hell and high water.
Yeah. I'm curious if you ever do, it seems like part of the process is that once you start to chip away at the layers of the narcissism, some of that depression does come up as they're recognizing, the guilt that arises of what they've done in the past. And I'm curious if that's something that you get some resistance in treatment or people dropping out of treatment as a result of that depression starting to arise, or how do you prevent that?
It's very important. Not only is it guilt, it's sort of a dismay that the solutions the person thought would work to make them feel better don't. Just a couple of days ago, I was supervising a case of a woman who had left her native country, which is a less developed country, gone to a European country, gotten a pretty good job, and for years she thought she could feel better with fancy clothes, fancy objects, designer objects, being the mistress of a high-level guy and taking fancy vacations. And in the course of therapy, she realized all this was really hollow. So her attempts to solve the problem just not only were taking her in the wrong direction, but were keeping her from doing what is necessary to really develop a full-bodied life from within. So when somebody says, I am suffering too much, I've got to stop this. First of all, we provide a little psychoeducation. We say, I understand what you're feeling. I know how distressing it is. And since you're not familiar with this process, please try to take into account what I'm saying. This is actually a positive development, because look at it. You're more in contact with the reality of the life around you. You're seeing things that aren't there that you would like to be there. It's very depressing, but this is a step in the right direction. And usually the person can hear that. If they do say, I just want to leave this treatment, we kind of do everything we can to persuade them to stay, including saying, I get what you're saying, but if there's one thing we know about psychotherapy, it's that it's when the going gets rough that you stand to gain the most. If you can stick with it now, I think this is going to be the most important part.
Mm-hmm. You started to touch on one of the questions that was sent in by one of our listeners, Nancy Gordon. She was curious about how much psychoeducation do you provide to the patients about these processes, and also about diagnosis to the patient?
We always discuss the diagnosis, but in an ideal world, or maybe not in an ideal world, I was going to say in an ideal world where cognition ruled, you could just explain the dynamics to somebody and they say, oh, okay, if I'm retreating into a grandiose self to avoid the real issues of life, let me just stop doing it. But we don't live in a purely cognitive world, which is probably good because we all have deep feelings. So a person's mind might tell themselves that, but their limbic system, the more emotional part of their brain is still saying, you can't trust people. They're going to want to put you down. There's this theory of mind experience, which is if their mind works a certain way, they're going to assume other people's minds work a certain way. If they grew up not being able to comfortably feel secure in a relationship, you can't just tell them to do so. So anyway, to get back to the psychoeducation, we always say, we think what underlies your symptoms and your problems in life is what we call a personality disorder. We give a kind of a layman's description of what a personality disorder is, including what I said about a self that's not fully coherent and a sense of inner distress and so on, and how this is related to acting out, if acting out is part of the picture. With my narcissistic patients, sometimes I will name it. Sometimes if I think they're very fragile, I won't name it because the term has such bad press in just plain English. But I might say, whether I name it, or suppose I do name it, I say, look, this is what we call narcissistic personality disorder, but don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to insult you. It's not the way we mean narcissism in English, which is to say you're arrogant and haughty and an awful person. In psychiatry, what we mean by narcissism is that you're tormented by not being able to live up to expectations that are unrealistically severe and exaggerated. So even though you might seem on the surface to be living the superior life, what I've ascertained in my assessment of you is you're suffering from a gap
between what you think you should be and what you really are. And that's making life miserable. It's hard to relate to others. So it would be something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're upfront and also gentle at the same time, keeping in mind that you're not trying to burst that bubble.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I wish that we had more time to talk this through, because this is just such an interesting topic, but I do want to make sure I have time to just wrap things up and make sure that everybody is directed to the right pages for where to access things and for next week's podcast.
Sure.
So do you have any last comments or things that you wanted to make sure that you got to that maybe glossed over earlier that you just want to give a few more words on?
Well, I just wanted to say, since this event is organized by NEA BPD, borderline personality disorder, as the field of personality disorder studies evolves, I think we're seeing more overlap between different ones, and certain research, like Carla Sharp's study of a couple of years ago, are talking about a G factor, which is emphasizing underlying core elements of the major severe personality disorders. And I think it's important to think that way so we can join our resources in trying to help understand and better treat our patients as we get to what's underlying these terribly serious conditions. And I just hope someday in the future we'll have an opportunity to talk again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And that is something that I noticed, that there was a lot of overlap in some of the ways you approach the treatment for NPD as with BPD. And so that would make sense if there is that core pathology that is there, that we would use elements of treatments in the same way and could gain more from that. So,
well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. I do want to wrap up. So for everyone that is listening, the audio and slides from today's call will be archived at www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. So please feel free to pass on the link to people in your network who couldn't make it tonight. And please stay tuned for our next talk with Jennifer Eden. It is on February 10th, and it's going to be on using DBT to treat adolescents and adults, and they're going to be focusing on the differences between the two forms of treatment. And you'll be lucky to have Andrea Gold as your moderator and host that night. And also a special thanks to all the members on our call-in planning committee. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. So thank you to Drs. Perry Hoffman, Andrea Gold, Emily Clooney, Carla Sharp, and Seth Axelrod. Please, we have a wonderful year planned for you all, so stay tuned.
Thank you to both of you so much.
Thank you, Perry.
Thank you, Perry.
Good night.
Night. Bye.